You are listening to Service Course by The Cycling Podcast, powered by Super Sapiens, energy management for committed athletes and coaches.
Hello, my name is Tom Wally and I'm with...
Lizzie Banks! Didn't know I was going to have to introduce myself. You're getting lazy, Tom. I'm going to have to take over the... going to have to do a Rose Manley and take over the lead role at this, right?
I don't know why I did it that way. I've got no idea. We should really talk about these. Lizzie, how's things?
I'm good.
How are you?
I'm good. I mean, you may have noticed that I'm sitting here in my dressing gown. So I guess things are back to normal. Yeah, channeling the pro life, like ride, eat, and then do pretty much nothing else. So yeah, I mean, I just had a little holiday and then just started riding again. So at the moment, it's pretty much a one-way ticket to Struggle Street. Every ride, I've got that feeling like, am I really getting paid to do this? Because I am so bad. But surely things can only get better.
It's funny, actually. Where are, compared to like previous years, off season, where are you at compared to previous years?
Oh God, that is a really good question, but a really tough question, because I kind of feel like I've only had 1 year when I had a proper off season. So I don't really feel like I have a proper frame of reference. And I've also had a really weird year, you know, a year with concussion, got cleared. Then I spent October training, but for no purpose other than to kind of prove to myself and other people that I was good to go again and to get some fitness before I took a holiday and then started again for a normal, you know, a normal build up to the season. So it's really nice now because I know what to do. I know how to do this period between now and when the racing starts in February. And I also know those feelings that I have right now when you just feel, I mean, I feel like I've been hit by a train because I've been in the gym. I feel like I'm pedaling squares and my watts are so low and I bonk after about an hour and a half. So, but I know that those things are normal and yeah, it goes pretty fast really. I think it was only my third or fourth ride back today. So yeah. I think probably around the same place as you would normally be after an off season. You always feel like hell, and yeah, you come around after a week or so. I'm hoping so. Going on training camp next week, so I better come around.
Yeah, listen. I mean, you've just told me about this training camp. I don't think I've ever heard of a rider going to Greece for a training camp.
Well, I mean. So yeah, I'm off to Greece next week, flying into Athens and then going to do a training camp in the Peloponnese region in Greece. And I kind of thought, why not? I mean, there are so many beautiful places to ride your bike and Greece will still be a little bit warmer than some of the other places. I've never been. And I mean, I've been doing some serious Google mapping and some serious sleuthing on Komoot. And there are just so many incredible roads out there and nobody else out there. So, yeah, I think I'm going to be a trendsetter here. And, you know, it's easy to go to Calpe or to go to Mallorca and those places are brilliant. But why not explore? You know, that's one of the things that really gives me the joy and the passion is just exploring, finding new places, new roads. And I am so motivated by that. And it's been such a long time since I've really been anywhere. Other than Belgium to pick up some bikes. so yeah, like that thought of kind of riding and pushing myself in somewhere new is just so hugely motivating. And why not explore a new area like Greece?
Lizzie's not able to tell you what bikes she went to pick up, but one day, next month, hopefully she'll tell us.
Teasing you, Tom. Teasing you, making you cling on for the next episode or Feminine where we make the big announcement. But I have some bikes.
You've given the announcement to Feminine, have you? We don't get to make it on our own podcast. That is outrageous. Well, listen. I mean, I've sort of collected a new bike. Well, actually, I've collected a new old bike. So I've moved house. I've left the Peak District now. I'm in Nottingham. I'll tell you what, Lizzie. By the way, it is a hell of a lot drier here. You would notice it immediately. It is
no
so
hills
dry
though.
To...
So I don't know. Yeah, but no, for no your hills, fixie, I guess that's pretty good. Which is handy, seeing as that is what we're talking about today.
Yeah. So I've been reconnecting. I mean, I've had a bit of a torrid time with. I guess we've both had a bit of a torrid time with cycling over the last year.
2022 is going to be our year of comebacks, Tom. Okay, well, I want to win a stage of the Tour de France. What do you want to do?
I just want to ride my bike again. Yeah. So I just, you know, I just haven't. Riding bikes is just part of who I am, and I just haven't been able to do it as much as I wanted. And I've been reconnecting with my fixed gear bike, which is my first sort of cycling love, really. So this episode, there's going to be coming up this sort of a big sort of quite another one of my big think. Remember the piece I did on graphene, or the piece I did on video games and cycling? It's one of those style sort of indulgent explorations, but I sort of go back to the roots of fixed gear culture, which, you know, back when I was living in London, sort of in the earlier part of the noughties, you know, you just couldn't move for people riding fixed gear bikes. It was just a huge scene, and then it sort of faded away. So it's a bit of an exploration of that. But in terms of fixed gear bikes, it's probably a good thing to be talking about, because you were at the National Hill Climb Championships. What was that, like 3 or 4 weeks ago?
Yeah, I was there, and it was truly bonkers. 31st of October. Halloween. And I guess, it was some pretty scary conditions, to be honest. The words biblical and epic are definitely overused, but I mean, they don't even do the conditions and the event justice to say those words. We were driving out, and notice I say driving out because it was really the worst weather I've ever seen in the Peak District, and I spend quite a lot of time in the Peak District. I have never ever seen so much standing water on the roads. I mean, it was just such a huge amount of rain that fell in such a short space of time. I went out with my friend and we parked in a field, and we just about got in, and thankfully the field was on a bit of a hill, so getting out you just kind of had to roll back down the hill, but getting into the field was a hell of a challenge. And then going up the climb, there was just a river running down the climb. There's a large grassy bank to the side of it, and you just couldn't walk up the grass because it was, yeah, just this muddy river flowing down. And I mean, the atmosphere was amazing. The number of people that turned out for that event, full waterproofs, despite the full waterproofs, everybody was soaked to the skin. Cowbells, pots and pans, you know, and everything you can imagine to cheer. And if you don't know the climb, when it's passed, Google it, because it is a natural amphitheater and it is just the most spectacular place to hold an event like this. And I kind of, you know, we could see what the weather was going to be like before, and we wondered, oh, is it going to dampen the atmosphere? And no, it honestly just made it better. Like, it made it just so brilliant. And, you know, it was almost like the race finished, and as soon as the race finished, stopped raining.
Well, I mean, it looked amazing. Now, you know, I was pretty thankful I wasn't able to attend because the weather was bleak. But on the fixed gear tip, so the previous record was set, you were just telling me, by Peter Greenhall.
Peter Greenhall in 1966, right? And this is completely bonkers when we move on to kind of how fast the new record was set this year. But the old record was set in 3 minutes, 11 seconds on around 7 kilo bike. So this guy, Peter Greenhalgh, he rode from Nottingham, to Winnetts Pass on a fixed gear bike. He raced
up this writes
it
itself.
On a fixie. I mean, it's definitely one of your forefathers. And then he rode home again. I mean, how bonkers is that? It was an FH Grubb steel frame with beautiful lugs, Brooks saddle, these really quite cool narrow handlebars, actually. And yeah, I mean, I'm quite impressed with how light the bike was for a bike that's so old. But yeah, I mean, the record has now been kind of, yeah, smashed. Or the men's record, I should say, has now been smashed. And it was broken twice. First by Andy Feather in a time of 3:08, and then by Tom Bell in a time of 3:01. And given the fact that the conditions were pretty horrendous, it's amazing to break the record, but it also shows how brilliant Peter Greenhalg must have been as a rider to have gone up there in 311. The difference in tech we have, you know, these bikes, Tom Bell's winning bike was 5.2, 5.4 kilos or something. Yeah, the whole thing is just bonkers. I mean, I would go online and search for the National Hill Climb Championships and go and have a look at some of those bikes if you can. But I mean, the other great thing about this race was the first women's Queen of Winnetts Pass was crowned as well. And so Bithya Jones, she raced up it in 4 minutes dead. And the brilliant thing, she was on a Tifosi Mons 10-speed Campag. And so that's what I love about the hill climbing scene. It's not about having, you know, the flashiest 10 grand bike that you, you know, take on a winter ride with no mudguards. It's about using what you've got and being innovative and being adaptive. I mean, some of the best things I saw, some of the most bonkers things, actually it was mostly my friends who had the most bonkers things, which maybe it says more about me. So a lot of people had these little rear lights, which were just simply an LED wired into a tiny battery. It was 2 grams. So the CTT rules, CTT is the kind of the federation that looks after hill climbs. So the rule is that you have to have a working rear light, and it flashes red, so it counts. So yeah, there's always a way around the rules. It's very Dan Biggum-esque, but just brilliant.
Oh, I wish I could have been there. Anything else that you spotted while you were out about sleuthing around?
Well, another friend of mine had an aluminium cassette, which was super lightweight, but actually quite funny, because at a previous hill climb, he started off in a bigger gear and put a bit too much torque through and snapped a tooth on it.
But I was gonna say, yeah, that feels like that could happen. Yeah,
thankfully
definitely.
He didn't need the big gears going up Winnetts. Rebecca Richardson, who we spoke to a couple of podcasts ago, and it was a really brilliant interview, so go back and listen to it. I think it was the September episode. If you haven't listened to that, please go back and listen to it, because she was third on the day in the women's category. Mary Wilkinson was second and Rebecca was third. Mary Wilkinson, by the way, quick shout out to her, she was second by 1 second. So brilliant ride by her. So Rebecca's ethos was 4.7 kilos and it was a disc brake bike.
Wow.
And so it had you know, the Zed string spoke wheels, which we featured before on the podcast back in November 2019. But another really, really cool thing is her saddle was fixed with polymer string. So instead of having your... I know, Tom. Tom's like giving me a confused look. Can't speak because he's so confused. What? So instead of a kind of standard, quite clunky saddle rail that actually weighs quite, or saddle kind of rail fixing, don't know what you call it, that weighs quite a lot, you've got two pieces of polymer string to hold the clamps in place, and that's instead of the screws.
Wow.
Yeah, absolutely bonkers, like really, really quite bonkers, but brilliant. No, just the whole thing was absolutely brilliant, and it was a huge success despite the biblical weather. But I have to say, I was there really purely on pleasure and not on business. And I completely forgot to actually check out the bikes because I was far too busy screaming at the riders and running up the hill. So having a whale of a time. But yeah.
Okay, Lizzie, well, before we move on, anything else that you spotted when you were there?
I mean, I guess the final thing was, it's quite interesting, actually, because this climb is... Yeah, it's 20% and it's a very steady gradient. It's a steady, absolutely horrendous gradient, which makes it really suitable for fixed gears. But despite that, I think there was only 2 or 3 fixed gear bikes there, but very, very, very few anyway, which was actually a bit surprising. But I think the reason, or a couple of reasons, to be honest, one is the fact that Winnetts Pass is... It's very changeable to ride. So if you happen to have a tailwind, which is unlikely, it's incredibly fast, relatively. But if you have a howling headwind, and actually it was lucky that the riders were riding in biblical rain, because later that day, there were gale force winds, which would have been howling in the riders' faces going up the climb, and then getting up would have been nigh on impossible. And so I think because of the the unknown nature of what the weather conditions were going to be doing, then actually you're kind of uncertain about what gear you want to ride, perhaps. The other thing about the weather conditions is that because it was so wet and the riders were putting out so much power over 3 or 4 minutes, a lot of the riders actually changed their rear wheel right at the last minute. So Tom Bell, he had this lightweight tubular on his front tire, and he switched out his rear wheel for a quite heavy training wheel with a Pirelli 25mm winter tire on the back. So like a heavy wheel, heavy tire, but it meant that he could actually go faster because he wasn't slipping. So a lot of the riders on the, well, I say the steep section, the whole thing was steep, but the over 20% section, when you're really, really pushing, they were sliding and slipping on their back wheel. And because he'd done that, he managed to kind of, well, I mean, he was obviously, you know, next level anyway, but he then had that advantage that he actually had the grip, and that is so important. Like, that is more important than, you know, a few hundred grams.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
This episode of Service Course is sponsored by LinkedIn.
Now, today, many small business owners are busier than ever. Time spent searching for and interviewing candidates can take time away from managing and growing a business. That's why LinkedIn Jobs has made it easier to get the candidates worth interviewing faster, and it's free. Now, we've used LinkedIn here at the Cycling Podcast to recruit producers. I've also used it personally for my own business. I work for myself as a freelance producer, so I'm often responding to job adverts on LinkedIn. I'm also pleading for jobs on LinkedIn and letting people know that I'm available. But I also have a production company myself called Stripped Media, and we've used LinkedIn ourselves to hire for big projects, radio production, podcast production projects that we're doing. You can create a free job post in minutes on LinkedIn Jobs, and it reaches the world's largest professional network with over 30 million people in the UK alone. Focus on candidates with the skills and experience that you need. Use screening questions to get your role in front of only the most qualified people. LinkedIn Jobs helps you find the candidates worth interviewing faster, and you can post a job for free. Just visit linkedin.com/cycle. Again, that's linkedin.com/cycle to post a job for free. Just a warning though, if you do post a podcast production job, I may apply.
Christmas is coming, and our gift to you this year is the Service Course press conference episode. Yes, we are back again for a second edition. So you can send in your questions, and they can be about anything, whatever you like. Gravel riding, graphene, space elevators, whatever you can think of, maybe fixie car park crits. Send them over and we will try and find a real expert, not just Tom and I, to answer your questions. So if you email your questions to contact@thecyclingpodcast.com and you put service course or press conference in the subject line, it'll find its way to us and we will answer those questions for you in the December episode of Service Course.
Hello, my name is Tom Wally and I love to ride bikes. Well, I once loved to ride bikes. A global pandemic, a growing family, a busy job and a house move mean that my 10 to 15 hours of riding and training in the Peak District every week is now 5 hours a week maximum, and that's all done in a garage in Nottingham pretty much. I can't overstate how important cycling has been to me. It's become a big chunk of my career, but it's also what helped straighten me out. Cycling stopped me from destructive things like smoking and drinking, and it gave me something more constructive to focus on. It got me fitter than I'd ever been before, and it's helped me make new friends wherever I've lived. Cycling got me so fit that I was able to race competitively, not at a particularly high level, but it took me further than I'd ever dreamed it would. I stopped racing in 2019 when I knew it was no longer sustainable to be away from my family for big chunks of the weekend, you know, between March and October every year. The idea was to stop racing but maybe start having more adventures on the bike and doing things like gravel events, and that way I could maybe take my family with me for the weekend, enjoy some camping and also get a fun ride in. But then the pandemic. And since then, my mental health, to be honest with you, it's just been in the bin. Cycling was such a big part of who I was that when I stopped, I felt lost and disconnected, and the social contact dried up because I wasn't out on the road with my former friends, and the anxiety that comes with a decline in fitness was incredibly pronounced. I'm now back living in a city, and I'm trying to get back to being the person that I was by utilising the bike that first made me fall back in love with riding. And that bike is my Fixie. My Fixie is nothing special. It's just a resprayed Genesis flyer frame. It's got some wheels whose brand I can't even remember. They're basically bomb-proof wheels. It's got Brick Lane Bikes chain rings and cranks, Shimano SPD pedals, and that is about it. I love the simplicity of fixed gear bikes, but not just that, it's the look of them. None of the lines are interrupted by derailleurs, rear brakes or excessive cabling, and I just love how modular they are. It's so simple to switch components out and quickly change the entire look of the bike. Even an idiot like me can do it. Now here's a question for you. Does anyone ever tell you that you look like someone? I get quite a few. Or at least I used to.
Hi, Dennis Pennis here, and I'm thinking to myself, has it really been 6 months since I've been in LA? Has
Dennis
really
Pennis. Okay. Rod Hull.
You know how to upset somebody, don't you? Yeah. Sorry about that. Yes, carry on.
Not the most complimentary. This one's a bit of a niche one. Spider Nugent from Coronation Street.
Oh, there you are. We've done a runner.
But fast forward to around 2008, and it was always this guy.
Did you want a cup of tea, Taz?
I couldn't eat a thing. My stomach's like a walnut.
Do you even have tea?
No salad.
Something orange?
Water.
And to be honest, I was pretty thrilled by it. Maybe it was watching Spaced in the early 2000s that set me on a path to becoming a fakinger. We'll talk more about that term later. A while back, I actually rewatched both series, and I noticed that Daisy often wears an Adidas hoodie made for the Criterium du Dauphiné, or Criterium Libre, as I think hers says. Was Spaced laying a path for me without knowing it? That's not what this episode is about, and for this latest piece of self-indulgence, and to make sure that we stay on message, talking about cycling tech, I want to celebrate the fixed gear bike and how it has helped me not only to get out riding again, but has also helped me with my mental health. But I also want to look at the current state of fixed gear culture, which was at its peak, you know, 10, 12 years ago when I was in London, and has since, well, it seemingly died a death, but I'm sure it still survives in some form.
I just thought that the idea that, you know, these two guys were going to make a book was going to just infuriate everyone.
This is Max Leonard, and he literally wrote the book on fixed gear bikes.
Actually, everyone was hyped and incredibly supportive, and we had a really good launch in London where everyone came along, we took over. It was actually a weird, like, fetish club / Lucha Libre space in an arch in Bethnal Green, which had been sort of passed on to me by a weird mate of mine. And so we put up a few posters and stuff because Andy, my co-author, was working at the council at the time, so he had access to, he could print A1. So he ran off some posters of images from the book and we put them up. And then at the very last minute, I realised that there was still a stripper's pole in the middle of the thing. And I was like, we can't have this in here. You've got to get rid of this. And the guy's like, you can't move. All these guys and girls piled into there. We had some bike, bike racks that we were going to construct, but we didn't manage to do it because we were stressed out and there was no time. So they just all piled in and everyone left their bikes around this place and sort of drank beer and looked at bike pictures around a stripper's pole, which was bizarre.
Stripper's pole, East London. Did I mention that it was a very Nathan Barley time to be alive? But I loved it. The story of where fixed gear culture began has never truly been settled on, and as Max talks about, a fixed gear bike meant very different things depending on when and where you grew up.
That's completely different in the UK. There's a long history, as I'm sure you know, of people riding fixed wheel through the winter and riding road path frames which are drilled for a brake and mud guards and all that kind of thing. So actually where we come from is very different.
But the most told story is that it began in New York.
It's what we investigated in the book. Was it had come from a group of African-American messengers in New York, I think it's in the 70s, who had sort of adopted the track bike, from racing the local velodrome, which I think is in Queens, and taken it out onto the street and used it as a machine for working the city, because it was didn't look valuable, it was very easy to fix, you could ride a very good bike, but no one would really notice. And then they grew up in that part of the world, the culture of riding brakeless, because that's how track bikes were.
That's always been the same story that I've told. Maybe some more evidence to support it can be found here. Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing from 1989 features a character dressed in a messenger or fakinger style, complete with a Brooklyn casquette. Spike Lee himself wore one. If you've seen Netflix's The Last Dance, then you'll have seen him in it as part of that Nike ad that he made with Michael Jordan. Cycling style is everywhere if you know where to look for it. The connection with New York is also underlined by Nelson Vales. Now, Nelson was the first black American cyclist to win a medal at the Olympics. He took the silver medal in the individual sprint at the 1984 Games in LA.
Nelson looks a little bit more relaxed up there. You can see he doesn't want to take the lead. He'd rather ride from behind.
You're only allowed to go backwards 5 centimeters here.
But they can sit here all day.
Right? He was great to talk to. He came out with some great lines. I think people have talked to him a bit since, but I don't think anyone had really asked him about that part of his life at that point. And yeah, he'd been a young kid growing up in one of the New York boroughs and became a courier and just realized that he was really fast. And so he was one of the kings of his particular dispatch company, and was racing at the velodrome, and he'd just come out with great lines like, we'd party all night, then we'd go get breakfast, then I'd go to the track and I'd beat your ass, and that kind of thing. And there was a real like competitive thing that I think New York bred, because it was a hard place to ride and a hard place to work. And New York is it's just a tough town to live in. It's a very dog-eat-dog kind of place. And actually, I think New Yorkers revel in that. And they think that if you can't stand it, well, then you need to get out. But it bred a certain sort of rider. It's funny, though, riding in New York seemed very different to me to London, and actually a bit easier. Because even though you've got, big four-lane roads and everyone, traffic is pretty mental, you were just going one direction. Everyone was going the same direction. It was pretty slow, actually. And so if you were riding at a decent speed, you could, go down Fifth Avenue or Third Avenue, or, I can't remember which of the ups and downs, but if you hit the lights right and the guys knew exactly the right speed to go, it's something like 18 miles an hour, but you could just ride a wave of green lights.
For me, it wasn't New York that turned me onto fixed gear riding. It was the films and images coming out of San Francisco that really made me take notice.
MASH, who put out all those amazing films in the kind of early mid-2000s, and are still going, they really were very wary, and they wanted us to make sure that we were getting the right things and that we were crediting the right people. And then, once we hung out with them a bit, it was all good vibes. But we went on a couple of photo shoots with them, or I can't remember if it's photos or videos, and watched a couple of their guys herring down the hills through the traffic and, having to do a left turn across two lanes and striking his pedal and all this sort of thing. And it was pretty hardcore. And I mean, even riding a track bike on any sort of normal gearing up and down San Francisco hills is pretty tough.
Riding fixed gear didn't just give me a love for fixed gear bikes and the occasional knee injury. Talking to Max, it also reminded me that it gave me a whole new lexicon.
Yeah, there's still slang that we use about bikes that you see today, that the hip-hop slave bike, and there was one called Pengi as well. If you look up Pengi bike still on Google, you'll find this amazing picture of a sort of orange and black thing with tri-spoke wheels, and it just the most wrong thing ever. And if something was Pengi, as opposed to actual London slang, peng means good, but pengy is just a shorthand for the worst looking, crappiest bite you could ever imagine.
I've used it here already, but there was also fakinger, someone who dressed like a bike messenger but wasn't one. A lot of this language came from LFGSS, the London Fixed Gear and Single Speed Forum. On occasion, one of the most toxic places on the planet, and a space that gave us a good preparation for the way discourse has gone on places like Twitter.
It was funny, yeah, how people would get, you know, flamed. It seems like quite quaint now in you know, the whole like cancel, the place that we are with cancel culture and stuff. But I've still got friends from the forum. I mean, Mark was like on the forum at that time. Mark Hudson, the archivist, and it was just you know, at one point I think it was like the third biggest bicycle forum in the world of any sort. And it was just a really amazing community, and that was probably something about Fixed that was appealing at that time.
Well, it was, I think it's one of those things where it was the best of times and the worst of times, because that was, I made a lot of friends through that forum who are still friends now. And it was, you know, any sort of community, which it was, you get a lot out of. But also it was basically an incredibly sexist and homophobic place in a way that largely went unchallenged. And I only realised quite a few years afterwards that that was why I stopped going there, not even deliberately, just because I sort of increasingly felt uncomfortable and not at home there. And when I had time to waste on the internet, I would end up going somewhere else, and eventually thought, oh yeah, I don't really go there anymore. Interesting. I mean, it is, I don't want to condemn it because I did get some good stuff out of there. But in hindsight, it was one of those things where you look back and think, that thing we thought did us all a lot of good actually was incredibly toxic.
That was Emily Chappell, who you'll know from episodes of Explore. She's an adventurer, a long-distance cyclist, and author. But she also spent time as a bike messenger during the peak years of Fixed Gear cycling.
There were a lot of people who really did think we were the lowest of the low. And if I told someone I was a courier, they'd say, oh, you all jump red lights, and they'd want to have that conversation. And then the other half of the people would be, oh my God, you're the coolest person alive. I've always wanted to be a cycle courier. Let me bask in your glory.
Emily paints a pretty ordinary picture of what it was like to be a bike messenger at that time, especially for someone like me, who thought that they were some of the coolest people on the planet.
What I realised is that the fakingers were actually way cooler than we were, because like, I could not afford to dress very well. And, you know, I didn't even look cool in ripped jeans. I just looked like a mess and smelt worse. My bike was a terrible mess because I could only ever afford to do the bare minimum to it. So you'd see these fakingers on their shiny, shiny bikes with all their modifications and things. And they, now you guys are absolutely killing it. We just look like tramps on bikes. So there was this weird sort of imbalance between how we were perceived. And then I do feel that often you were sort of, if you were not one of the cool looking couriers, you were sort of passed over because you weren't really worth aspiring to. So there were all these, I do remember like every summer there'd be a few new people who'd come in who were clearly just people on their university holidays. And they were always, you know, tall, athletic, good-looking young men in singlets. And they were the ones who, I think, you know, the street photographers would get them. Everyone would be like, oh, yes, a cycle courier in his natural habitat. And I'd be there kind of still smelling from winter, thinking, well, I mean, this is the real thing, but I guess that's less interesting. So I don't know, we were sort of way more authentic, and then in a way almost less authentic in terms of the image that people were expecting, if that makes sense. There was a continuity, and you know, I was part of both scenes. It wasn't completely separate. I was riding, the first couple of years I was riding this knackered Condor Pista that I bought off someone dodgy for 200 quid, and it was, I never liked it. I hated it. I didn't get on with it at all. I'd had a really nice steel frame, a Surly Steamroller, and about 2 months before I became a courier, I crashed it and bent it, and that was, I'm still a bit sore about that. And that would have been an amazing bike to courier on, but as it was, I had this shitty Condor Pista that I didn't like. And then eventually I got to the stage where so much was broken on the Condor that it really wasn't worth replacing it all. And a friend sold me a really, really nice Joe Waugh frame, which I still have. which is unbelievably knackered. And now I live in Bristol and it's been tagged as well. I locked it up outside a shop and someone tagged it, which I love. I was almost always on fixed. There were a couple of geared interludes where basically if I broke the bike, or at one point I think my lock broke, so the bike was trapped outside my house and I had to borrow a friend's road bike. But I was mostly on fixed, and that was just, as far as I was concerned, the way to do it. Partly for practical reasons, because it's cheaper to ride fixed. There are fewer parts and there's less stuff to break. And I was used to it, and it felt, you know, I had much more control over the bike. It felt easier to ride through traffic. It was more, you know, you could control your line a lot more closely. With a geared bike, it just felt like you sort of launch yourself and then hope for the best. But with a fixie, you could really sort of, you know, every time a car moved, you'd be like, oh, okay, modify. So I did, but I haven't ridden it for a long time.
Talking to Emily, it struck me that a lot of the spaces inhabited by the fixed gear scene were actually pretty toxic, particularly the forum that I spoke about earlier. It made me think about Emily's experience as a female in the scene.
I think I'm probably still forming and revising my opinions on this, because I mostly felt welcome when I turned up. But one of the only reasons I felt able to turn up to stuff like, you know, courier events, Fakinger events, London Fixed Gear, pub meets and things, was that I was fairly credible. Like, I always had reasonably good bikes. Like, the Surly, it was very customised and people loved it. I was always happy to turn up with that because people would check it out. And I was like, yeah, you may check out my bike. I do too. And also I was fairly, you know, legitimate as a rider. I mean, I was a fucking cycle courier, you know, I was the highest high. So I sort of felt I could get away with turning up and also being female. And, you know, whatever inadequacies that showed about me, I made up for them by having a nice bike and being a bike messenger. The fact that I felt like that, I don't know. I mean, this is not exclusive to this community by any means. This is a lot of the bike scene. I think it's very hard to show up to events knowing the way you will potentially be judged or ripped to shreds if you don't fit in. And there is, I mean, it was with that community in particular, there was this sort of, a bit like how it's worked out with the rules. You know, it started out as a very, very tongue-in-cheek thing, like we're tending to be really judgmental about your bike. And by the end of it, people were actually just being really judgmental about each other's bikes. Like, you know, the irony eventually fades out, and that's just the way things are.
Inevitably, with something underground that carries a cultural value, it starts to peak above ground and turn that cultural value into actual monetary value. That's kind of what happened with fixed gear cycling, and particularly when you think about stuff like the Red Hook Crits, which were organised fixed gear street races that were a world away from the illegal races and alley cats that were a big part of the culture. But the Red Hook Crits were great, and sadly they are no more, but some of the riders who rode them have now ended up in the pro peloton, and one such rider is TIBCO Silicon Valley's Tanya Erath. In 2017, she won 7 of the 12 fixed gear crits she raced in. She took 3rd during the Red Hook Crit in Barcelona and finished 5th in the overall classification. And what's more impressive is that she raced her first fixie crit 2 weeks after her first ride on a fixed gear bike. That same year, 2017, she also won the Zwift Academy competition, which gave her a pro contract with Canyon SRAM. Oh, and she's also an actual doctor. I spoke to Tanya while she recovered from her recent back injury sustained during the women's tour.
I'm still lying on the couch, as you might be able to see. I fractured 2 vertebra body, so bed rest for most of the past 5 weeks, which is quite hard when you come out of, like, yeah, racing and being in top form for Roubaix, and then like 2 days later suddenly you're stuck in a hospital bed, not even able to go to toilet or have a shower, nothing. So yeah, that was quite a challenge, but it's getting better from day to day. So yeah, the thing is with a fractured spine, it's always quite like, it's a threatening thought to think about, like, okay, that could have been like the end of me walking around and cycling. Mm. So it's like, yeah, sometimes like when you lay in bed after the injury and you like have time to think about all of it, it just makes you like a bit panicked because you're like, okay, I was just lucky. And also because, the NHS nightmare was like, I wasn't immobilized. They didn't put me on a spine board. They didn't give me a stiff neck. I was dropped off at the team parking and then the team drove me to the A&E where I sat for like 6 hours, I guess. And I walked around and I carried my bag. And even if when they saw the fracture on the x-ray, like I walked to the CT scan, carried my back around, and I was just like, this is like everything that's happening here is just like so wrong. And it was awful because like I'm a doctor myself and like I could tell like this is not right, but in the same time you need the help, so you're just like, okay, like I'm just gonna roll with it because there's nothing I can do. I just need those people to help me. So yeah, I was quite intense first week, and then like getting back from the UK was quite a struggle because I had a flight arranged from the insurance, but because of the fuel shortage they couldn't get me from Oxford to London Heathrow. So in the end they ended up sending an ambulance from Germany to Oxford and then they drove me home 13 hours. So yeah, it was very interesting.
Now I've been riding fixed gear for the best part of 15 years, but unlike Tanya, I have never dared race it, certainly on a road or, you know, crit circuit. So I asked Tanya what kind of skills you need to race essentially a track bike on the road.
I don't know, like maybe I just had another approach to it, but it was like I was a triathlete, then I did a few like small road races. And then somebody said, oh, I think you could do some fixed gear races with us. Why don't you come with us? So I went on a track bike the first time. And then 2 weeks later, I did my first race. So I don't think that it acquires a lot of skill because compared to like, I think half a year later, when I went to the pro peloton, I was like, oh my God, what am I doing? Like, what's happening here? And like fixed gear racing just felt so natural because it's like, it's not like, you're in a bunch and you can't see what's coming up. And like, you just have to trust the people around you, like showing you signs and doing stuff. And like, everybody like hammers into a corner because they know if I'm not in position, race is over. It's just like, you're on a 1K track or like 1.5K track or circuit. And everybody's just racing and it's so smooth because nobody breaks and it's kind of a constant speed. So I think compared to road racing, it's really smooth racing. So I guess the only real skill you need is like knowing that you can't brake and don't fight your bike and just like keep pedaling. I think that's the only thing that can happen, that like what people also do on the track sometimes, that they just like stop pedaling and then their own pedals like smash them off the bike.
But obviously fixed gear, I mean, you know, the racing's one side thing, but the lifestyle, the scene, everything. Were you part of the fixed gear scene sort of away from the crits as well then? Was that a big part of your life?
Not really. Like, I mean, during the time that I raced fixed gear, I did my final year of university studying medicine, and the final year in Germany is working full time in the hospital. So yeah, like I went on the weekends, I sometimes went to fixed gear races, and on Monday I went on the ward again. So yeah, not really a fixed gear lifestyle.
That's really interesting. I mean, in terms of the lifestyle, actually, it's obviously we talk about Red Hook, but you know, Red Hook has sort of since disappeared. Do you still keep in touch with what's happening in the fixed gear scene? I mean, because over here, I mean, you know, now there's no Red Hook, you'd be hard pushed in Britain to find a fixie race.
So the NL Crits series is still happening, and a lot of my friends from back then, like I used to spend a lot of time with like the Dutch fixed races, and they are still racing. And then Margot Vigier, she's now racing for Valcar. So she also stepped into the pro racing scene, and we used to race Red Hooks together. So I see her from time to time. And yeah, I guess just like, I mean, Instagram and social media in general makes it happy just like stay in contact and talk to people from time to time. But yeah, I mean, since the Red Hooks are not happening anymore, I'm not sure if it's just like me leaving the bubble that I feel like fixed gear racing became smaller, because it's always like if you spend your time in a bubble, you're like, oh, this is huge, this is my life. And then you get out of the bubble. I had the same with triathlon. And then suddenly you realize like nobody cares about outside of your bubble. It's the same. And I like fixed gear is a small sport, but then like triathlon is a huge sport. But like as soon as you like leave your bubble, you're like, nobody knows the people I know because nobody's interested in triathlon. And I kind of feel like it's the same with fixed gear racing. So like from the outside, I can't really judge if it just became way smaller or if it's just me leaving the bubble.
In terms of what it gave you, I'm really interested, you know, because obviously we'll talk a bit about how you, I mean, you've talked about this loads, but how you came into the sport and how you got your contract. But fixed gear was a big part of that. What do you think it gave you? And what does it still maybe give you to this day?
I just want to come back to what you just said. So I think that's a good point. Like, that's also a reason why I came into fixed gear racing, because I thought, okay, like in my practical year, I won't really have a lot of time because working hours are like 60 to 80 hours a week, I guess. But I was like, I can always do like a half an hour crit. So it was like, okay, I'm just going to put like a few hours in like every day or like 1 hour in. And that's going to be enough to make like a half an hour race. Whereas it wasn't enough to do like a road race of 120K. So I think it's a good point that you just said, like, if you don't have that much time, fixed gear is just, it's kind of like, indoor riding. It's just like really intense because you never stop pedaling and you kind of have to use your legs for braking, for accelerating. You have your one gear that you're kind of stuck in. So it's kind of, you make good cadence work. So it's really good, like intense training if you don't have a lot of time. So that's also like a upside, I think, of fixed gear in general. And I mean, they used to do it back in the days in the winter. So I guess it has some really good. I don't have the word. What was really a benefits, yeah, for training. Sorry. And yeah, what did it give me? Like, I think in general, it gave me confidence. Like coming into the fixed gear scene and not knowing anyone and not knowing what I can do, and then realizing, oh, I'm really like, I'm good at that. And I can race with those girls. And also having some pro girls racing Red Hooks, whereas you never had the chance to race with the pros when you did only like smaller local races. And then suddenly there was like Danny King racing with us, or Rachele Barbieri, and those girls that I only knew from TV. And suddenly I was racing with them. And I realized, like, it's not like they drop me or they're like, I'm not able to keep up with them. And that made me kind of, I think, realize that I can go for maybe a pro contract. And I think I without the Red Hooks, I wouldn't have the confidence to maybe give Swift Academy a shot and then go where I am now. So I think, yeah, confidence for sure. And more style, because I came from triathlon. So
yeah, definitely.
I mean, it was kind of, in the beginning, it was also kind of annoying because I felt like you don't, like, that's what I really like about triathlon is like you can look the way you want and nobody's going to judge you as long as you're fast. And in cycling, I feel like even if you're fast, people are always going to judge you for how you look. And I'm not sure what I like more. I think, like, from my personality, I like the triathlon approach more, but then I really like the way I look now more than I used to.
Yeah.
So yeah, I guess I'm happy that fixed gear racing changed my style on the bike.
mean, obviously, you know, I mean, we should talk about how it relates to sort of, I guess, to Zwift. And because obviously, you know, you came through the Zwift Academy. I was just, in fact, I just bookmarked one of your workouts on Zwift, actually, an hour long one, because that's all I get these days is an hour, you know. So that's what I can do. But you're right. I mean, I think that comparison, that sort of efficiency, you know, if I'm out on my fixie, yeah, I'm never taking a minute's breather. And that is the same thing on Zwift. And I guess, you know, when I'm on Zwift or any of the platforms, I can manage that, you know, that never stopping, because I've got, you know, 10, 12 years of that in my background. It's there. Yeah. I mean, that must have helped you surely massively.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I guess being 10 years in triathlon helped even a bit more.
Yeah.
Because I mean, I've only been in fixed gear racing for one season in the end. But yeah, I think the biggest plus from fixed gear racing was probably like the skills. Because like I learned how to ride on rollers, like I learned how to corner, and I just like spent hours on my bike, just like riding in circles, which I never did with a road bike, because like with a road bike, you just like go out and yeah, do your kilometers. And with a fixed gear bike, you just like work on your skills. And I mean, now in road racing on a pro level, you realize how important it is to have certain skills. So yeah, I think the skills that fixed gear racing gave me are also like a big plus from that time.
That was Tanya Erath, and she'll be riding with EF Education TIBCO SVB next year, so keep your eye out for her results. Before we close out this little trip through the fixed gear phenomenon, I wanted to know where the culture is now at this moment in time. Here's Max again.
I think it must be inevitable that as these things spread, the heat goes out of it. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, because, you know, a lot of people will still be riding their fixed gear bikes and enjoying it, and it was a gateway to a lot of people to riding a road bike or mountain bike, or getting into cycling and fitness, which is a pretty amazing thing to do. You know, I made friends from there, went to the Pyrenees. So I started, you know, one of the first times I went riding in the mountains properly. So I don't think you could really recreate that moment, but, you know, I'm still living in Hackney now, or I'm back in Hackney, and I do keep my eye on what people are riding. And actually, it seems to me in the past year or two that I've started seeing what I would think of as a retro bikes. They're builds from, you know, my particular moment of things I used to geek on when I was, you know, late 20s, early 30s, you know. The tri-spokes, the particular like little riser bars, stuff like that. So I think that people are just going on with it quietly, and the forum is still huge. It's still massive. Yeah, I mean, I think people talk less about fixed gear, and you know, it is a general bike forum full of enthusiasts. I know there's a lot of people talk about gravel and Audax and that kind of thing, because I don't chat much on it anymore, but I get notifications every now and again about books and stuff, and I chip in when I can.
I mentioned earlier about the language that the fixed gear scene gave us. Max reminded me of some more.
You were talking about all the slang. I was just thinking, we used to think cool things 531, which was awesome.
But the most widespread term used in that scene was bike porn. And so I asked Max to talk about a particularly beautiful bike that he remembers from back in the day. And unsurprisingly, this took us to Japan.
Yeah, the Japanese Kirin Leagues, as you probably know, had a very strict system of classification for those frames you're allowed to ride and all the components and anything that you were allowed to use. Well, you had very particular frame builders that could build frames, but any other components were stamped NJS, which was the name of the Kirin League governing body. And so there was this, you know, intense fetishism and search for NJS bits. And when we were doing the book, we went to Tokyo, and so we got in touch with the JKA, the Japanese Kirin Association. And for some reason, that I think they thought that we were important. So they kind of welcomed us with open arms and took us to, we went to Kirin school. We went to a couple of Kirin races on their ticket and got to see some amazing things. But we did talk to Koichi Nakano, who is one of the most most celebrated and successful Kirin racers ever. And I think we saw one of his bikes. And if you're looking for a perfect bike, an NJS frame that's absolutely specced out right, he rode for Nagasawa, which is one of the big builders. And I think a Nagasawa in a particular shade of red with the Dura-Ace Shimano high flange hubs and the right saddle and that sort of thing, Nitto bits, that would, to me, would be an absolutely breathtaking bike.
My thanks to Max, to Emily and to Tanya, and thanks to you for coming on this little self-indulgent trip back in time, only a decade or so back in time, but back in time nonetheless. And if you do happen to be cruising around on your fixie in Nottingham, give me a wave. Maybe we'll go for a ride together.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you, as ever, to Science in Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast and all that we do throughout 2021 and all the years before that. They've been with us for such a long time and we are so grateful for their support. I need to stock up on a few Science in Sport things myself, and often I'll send a few out as a Christmas presents to my cycling friends as well. If you want to get 25% off your next order with Science in Sport, then go to scienceinsport.com and enter the offer code SISCP25. That's SISCP25.
It's very interesting to chatting to Tanya in that package. She's very keen next year. Obviously, she's got the alternative race calendar with EF being on board with her team. Yeah, she's hoping to be able to race some fixed gear crits as part of that. I was wondering, Lizzie, if that'd be something that might appeal to you, you know, the fixed gear racing, because you've never ridden a fixed gear, right?
So, yeah, I don't know if this is now the time to admit that I've never ridden an outdoor fixed gear bike. Can we still be friends?
Listen, I think I don't want to encourage you to do it because, you know, it could send you on a completely different path and you've got classics to try and win, you know.
Yeah, but, I mean, I guess
it's so addictive.
I've not had that many bikes, you know, and I never had the luxury of having loads of money to buy loads of different bikes. And so I had one bike and I've always really had one bike and only very recently got a second bike, which is a mountain bike. And I guess living in a really hilly place, a fixie never, ever occurred to me. And I actually read Emily Chappell's books, both of which are brilliant. I'm going to do a quick plug for her for Christmas. And if you do want one, then go and send her a message over on social media, because I think she's doing a Christmas postal run soon. But absolutely brilliant books. I had no idea what a cycle courier was. I didn't even know that it was a thing. But surely it's the way of the future. I mean, you know, deliveries are getting so much more common. We can't just have cars everywhere. It just doesn't make any sense. Like, it's so fast to get around cities on the bikes. Sorry, I've kind of gone off piste here, but yeah. Basically,
you're stalling, Lizzie. Are you going to race a fixed gear crit?
Am I going to? Yeah. Oh, that's why. That's why I like quickly diverted from the Lizzie, will you race a fixed gear crit? To let's talk about Emily Chappell. No, Tom, I will not be racing a fixed gear crit. I feel like I've had enough concussions for my career in cycling. But I mean, if there's one of those uphill car park races, do they do those on fixies?
Yeah, that was all part of the scene, these sort of, you know, yeah, race up an empty car park in the evening. You know, I was not something I ever did. And I've got to say, you know, all the time that I was riding fixed, I still do, I was always legal. You know, I've always had a front brake and, I was never taking part in alley cats and these illegal races and stuff. But they were very much part of the culture. And, you know, they were pretty cool, really. You know, you can still, I mean, I still do every night, you know, watch those sort of videos on YouTube. And I'm, you know, it's, for me, it's a bit like how the old skateboard videos were for skaters, you know. Stick a great soundtrack on it, fisheye lens, and loads of people riding nice fixed gear bikes around San Francisco. And I'm into it. It's, I just, you know, I'm a sucker for that stuff.
Yeah, totally. It's just, it's like a whole nother genre. It's like a whole nother world that I just don't know about. And I guess, yeah, one day I'll have to dive head first into it. I need to get myself a fix.
Don't dive head first into anything, Lizzie. Yeah, stop diving head first into things.
That is a very good idea.
That's where you've been going wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely not dive head first straight into it. But yeah, I mean, the only fixed gear bike I've ridden has been on the track, and it, you know, I've really not done much on the track. I was the year that I started riding, the university said, hey, do you want to do Bucks track? And you know, I'm the kind of person, if someone says, do you want to do it, I say, yeah, sure. And so I think I did two taster sessions on the track, and then went and rode Bucks, which is the inter-university competition, and the sprint and the IP and a few different events, and it was great fun. It was really, really great fun. But I guess, yeah, there's some other kind of track headlines, fixie headlines at the moment, isn't there?
Well, I mean, Lionel and Rich have been at the Ghent 6 Day for a start, so it's all fixed gear around the cycling podcast. But yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, there was Alex Dowsett's hour record attempt, which, I mean, sadly, you know, he didn't pull it off. But I still think the actual effort had the impact that was intended, you know, for his charity and all that sort of stuff. But also, I mean, it was just interesting to see the tech and the kit that he was riding, really. Yeah. That's why.
Oh, it was bonkers. I mean, we watched it, and it was, yeah, screaming at the TV for him. And, you know, he was out in Aguascalientes in Mexico and in an empty stadium, which I think is so hard because you really feed off that crowd. And, you know, throwing back to the National Hill Climb Championships, there were so many people there that the riders at the end said that their ears were just ringing because it was just such a wall of noise. And so when you know, you have nothing left, you don't even feel that pain because you feed off that atmosphere and that crowd. And then going back to when Alex Dowsett set the hour record quite a few years ago now, probably should have looked this up. I can't remember what year it was. And he set it in Manchester.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it was a full crowd. It was a full crowd at the velodrome there. Mm. And that makes such a huge difference. But yeah, it was an amazing attempt, and I think that whatever the outcome was, you know, he didn't beat the record, he didn't beat the British record, but he raised so much money and awareness for his charity Little Bleeders, which helps out young haemophiliacs, you know, provides them with, you know, a way to do sport, because, you know, he was So often told that, you know, don't do this, don't do that. And actually, he is a professional cyclist, and he manages it so well. And, you know, the medication is so good now that you can live a normal life. And yeah, it's absolutely brilliant. Just the amount of awareness he's raised for young haemophiliacs, regardless of anything else, whether he'd broken the record or not. But then there is so much cool kit. I mean, it's bonkers how much effort goes into a record
into such a simple, into essentially what is a simple bike. I mean, I was in touch with his coach, Hutch. Dr. Hutch is his coach, and he was out there with him, and sort of texting back and forth. They were actually out there during Day of the Dead, the Mexican festival, where everyone paints their face, and I was quite disappointed that Alex hadn't painted his face for the attempt. I thought that would have been a bit more aero, but I couldn't get Hutch to agree to that, sadly. But yeah, I mean, the amount of work that goes into it, just not even, you know, just the tech, but logistically wise, is amazing. But there was some pretty expensive stuff being used.
Yeah, but I mean, first back to logistics, I think that it's also very easy for outsiders to assume that there is a team of people organizing everything, and that Alex
It was four people,
and that Alex just has to turn up and ride his bike. But it's not the case, you know. He and his partner Chanel and you know, I'm sure Hutch as well, have been working for months to prepare this, and there's so much time and effort that goes into finding the money, being worried about whether you've got the money, trying to refine equipment, like time in the wind tunnel, traveling to the wind tunnel, time training in the position, just, you know, all of these things, it takes so much time and energy to refine everything and get everything right. And, you know, this is cycling. This is not football, you know? Alex is doing this pretty much off his own back, and that is what makes the whole thing so impressive. But yeah, I mean, just his skin suit alone, right? It was a Vortec skin suit, thousands of pounds it cost, and it's an asymmetric skin suit. So because he is going in left-hand circles, anti-clockwise circles around the track, there's stuff going on the left-hand side of the suit, which isn't going on the right. Because the airflow is slightly different on the left, because you are leaning slightly to the left the majority of the time. And, you know, the details like that, it's just mad, really. It's just mad how much effort goes into it. I mean, it's, yeah.
Do you know what, Liz? The more I think about this, I think you and Gabriel would be a good team for doing the hour. I think a project between you and Gabriel would be I think that'd be quite good, an hour record project. I'm just trying to encourage you to do all these things that you don't want to do. What am I doing?
I'm fine, thanks, Tom. I mean, you know what? I kind of am tempted by the hour record. I in some ways I am, but it also, you know, any goal requires so much sacrifice and dedication to that specific goal. And I guess there are so many other things that I want to do. And I feel like I've not even had a full season in Europe, you know? I feel like 2019 was maybe my only full season in Europe. 2020, you know, we all know what happened then. And then this year I wasn't able to ride. So, I think I'm just going to race a season and get that under my belt, and then this time next year come back to me and we can talk about our record and fixed gear crits in the car park.
Nice. Well, listen, Lizzie, I'm going to let you go. When are you going to be on Cycling Podcast Feminine making that big announcement about what you're doing next year? When can we look at when can I listen to that?
Hopefully soon. Hopefully at the end of this month, and if not, we can talk all about it in next month's podcast.
Well, Lizzie, I look forward to you telling someone else before you tell me. I can't wait.
Everybody, he already knows. He's known for months.
I'll speak to you next month, Lizzie. Maybe.
Maybe, if the Cycling Podcast Feminine don't get there first. Well, thanks, Tom. And glad you're somewhere flatter that you can enjoy riding your fixie again now.